Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm excellent. Excellent. Excited about our show tonight. We're going to have some fun with this one.
Yeah, well, we just spent the last, two or three minutes talking amongst ourselves, you and our guest and myself, about what a great show this is going to be. So if it's possible to jinx a show, I think we've done it. But I still have a
I'm not
a
at all
feeling. I'm not either. I think it's going to be great. I'm going to go ahead and bring out our guest. He is Tobias Buckell, a Caribbean-born speculative fiction writer who grew up in Grenada, the British Virgin Islands, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. He's published stories in various magazines and anthologies. He is the New York Times best-selling writer of Halo, The Cult Protocol, as well as a number of other novels. His next book, Arctic Rising, comes out in early 2012. Tobias, always a pleasure to have you on the program with us.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. And, boy, I feel like I've got this huge weight on my shoulder here. I'm going to have to be entertaining or you'll never have me back.
Well, but there's just no risk. There's no danger. Let me tell you why. This is great. I've been running the Monday evenings as the Fast Forward Archives. And just a few weeks ago, actually, when I said to Stephen, we've got to have this guy back on the show after listening to this program, although we'd been meaning to have you back on for a while anyhow. But this was an early on show. It was actually your second time on. I was thinking first time earlier, but no, this is the second time we'd had you on. But it was still very early in when we were doing this on Blog Talk Radio. It was right around the holidays, 2007. And so we're having a science fiction author on, and we set up the theme for the program was going to be how futurists and science fiction writers, what they have in common. That was the, as tonight we're talking about the future of publishing, that show was going to be about those things. So we bring you out, we have a few minutes of preliminaries, and then we introduce this topic, and it was kind of like, Stephen and I said, yeah, they kind of do have a lot in common. And you were kind of like, yeah, they do. And then we spent 90 minutes talking about dumb movies. It was just, awesome.
We completely ditched the topic and had a lot of fun anyway.
It was like Omega Man, Beneath the Planet of the Apes. It was So I feel that, this we can do anything we want to here. This is a guaranteed good show because the three of us get each other's reference. I mean, I don't know how good it is for the audience. But we have a great time.
Forget the audience. At least we're having fun, right?
Exactly.
We're having a good time.
Yeah, we're entertaining ourselves and hope the audience comes along for the ride. Exactly.
Well, I really do believe. I think excitement is infectious.
Yeah.
I think so, too. In fact, I was listening to that archive show, and I was sitting just laughing my head off. And my wife came in and said, what are you doing? Aren't you doing your podcast? And I said, yeah, this is an old one. It's really good. So she didn't get into the spirit, though. She just walked away like I'm insane. However, all right. So we are going to get caught up on what's happening with you lately. So catch us up. It's been I think a couple of years now since we've had you on. What have you been working on, and what can you tell us about Arctic Rising?
Sure. Well, I've been working on a number of different projects. 2010 in particular was a very productive year for me because I was recovering from convalescence of from 2009. So I've been really kind of trying to pour on the afterburners and structure my life to get as much work done as possible. And I've got a new novel that'll be coming out called Arctic Rising, and it's a sort of I call it ecological science fiction techno thriller. I know that my friend Paolo Bacigalupi has kind of made that popular, but I've actually been working on this damn thing for 3 years. back when Carl Schrader and I first wrote a story called Mitigation, which is set in a sort of polar north where all the ice has sort of disappeared and there's a seventh ocean and a resource rush in the near future. And I was so intrigued by the setting that I asked Carl a while back, you know, do you mind if I kind of run with this in a novel form? And he said, no, go for it. So I started working on it. I fell ill from a heart defect and wasn't able to finish it in early 2009 like I'd been planning. And so I just now got the rewrite notes from my editor back for it. But it's something I've been working on for like 3 years and been very excited about. So I'm looking forward to that coming out. I just recently had a novella out called The Executionist. There's a very beautiful print edition of it out from Subterranean Press, and Audible.com did that. And that was, I mentioned Paolo Bacigalupi, he and I did that together. We kind of created a shared world, sort of like a fantasy world, and both each wrote a novella set in it, which was a lot of creative fun. And Audible.com bankrolled us doing that. And then we sold the print rights to Subterranean Press. So that's kind of what I've been doing. Cool. I've got a couple other novels under my belt, but no one's really we haven't really sold those yet. So, you know, no particular hurry, but 2012 should be a real exciting year. And 2011, there'll be a lot of new short stories for me coming out. I think I've sold 6 or 7 already.
Oh, wow.
So should be a banner year for me for short fiction. And then 2012.
Short fiction. So what's the market like these days for short fiction? You're able to, where does one publish short fiction these days?
Yeah, there are a lot of great markets for short fiction these days for science fiction writers. I came in during a real dark period. I mean, a lot of the older writers always talk about the glory days of the pulps and back when there were a lot of magazines out that bought short fiction. And mm-hmm. when I came into the market in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was grim. There weren't a lot of places that were paying good money for short fiction.
Right.
And now online, there are a lot of markets that pay top dollar, and there are a lot of different things people are experimenting with. And I just, for some reason now, and maybe it's also partly that I've reached a different stage in my career that a lot more people are kind of knocking on my door saying, hey, do you want to be a part of this? Or, hey, can
right.
I get a story for this? But it seems to me that there are more opportunities now to sell to some really cool markets that pay a lot of money or pay good money. And it's healthy. And ClarksWorld.com is one place that I have sold a number of short stories to of late, Clark's World magazine. And, you know, I love working with Neil there. He's the editor. You know, John Joseph Adams has been putting together a lot of fantastic anthologies. And he's really become, I think, one of the great anthologists around right now. And so he's been taking some stories from me. He also runs Lightspeed Science Fiction and has taken a story there. And we have another magazine online, Subterranean Online, Subterranean Magazine, and Bill has taken a couple stories there from me for upcoming issues. So it's been really cool because for me as a writer, I love online sales, always have, if they pay as, you know, the commensurate rate, which they do, because your potential for readership is sort of unlimited. You know, once
right.
the story goes up at the online zine, you know, you have the potential to get so many more readers than if it comes out in a paper magazine. Now, obviously, like places like Analog and Asimov's and Fantasy and Science Fiction have, you know, decent readership. I think, you know, anywhere from 14 to 20 some thousand subscribers, you know, plus pass around, you know, so you probably have a exposure rate of 30,000 people if you publish in one of those magazines. And of course, people who subscribe to those magazines vote in, you know, for awards, and that's paid close attention to. But gosh, man, I love being in a Clark's World magazine, you know, issue, because, you know, not only does he, you know, not only does Neil say that, you know, he's getting tremendous amounts of traffic, but just as traffic to the other parts of the website build and as he keeps growing his magazine, you know, people go to the archives to read stories that they've missed. And so you just get continuous building readership over time. And I think that's just a really powerful thing, because I get a lot of readers who sort of discover me, you know, now, even though I haven't had a book out in a couple of years here, they'll discover me and suddenly go buy all my books and say, oh my gosh, I discovered you on Clark's World, or I read a story of yours at this website and I was pretty jazzed up about it. So I think it's a cool world out there, though it's not nearly as obviously as big as it was in, say, for example, like the 80s or even during the pulp era.
Well, it's great that, you know, people find a way to consume short fiction. People like short fiction. You know, I mean, they like reading short stories. So
sure.
It's always puzzled me. It's like, why isn't there a good business model around this? So it's gratifying to hear that that it's made something of a comeback.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are two responses I'd have to that. Like, one of them is immediately that actually short fiction is actually a hard sell to readers, to be honest, though. Because not to promptly disagree with the wonderful host of the show, but one of the problems is that when I talk to people is that with short fiction, when you read something, it takes time for you to invest in, particularly non-genre readers. It takes time for people to invest in a world that's being created, and particularly in genre fiction, you have to figure out who the characters are, where they are, and what the world building is to sort of set up that operating system in your brain of what this, you know, imaginary world is. And so I find that readers tend to prefer novels because once you've done that initial stage of setting up in your head the world that these people live in, you can kind of coast on through that and enjoy it for a very long time. Whereas with short fiction, you're always rebooting, you know, every new short story. And so if you find something you're enjoying, you're kicked out of it in a couple hours. And if you find something that you don't like, then you've just moved out of something you've liked into something you don't like. And I think that's responsible maybe for a bit of the hesitance people have. And even when you sell short story anthologies, it's really hard at times to get people to invest in buying them because they don't want to do that. They don't want to keep getting kicked out. They'd rather just read a novel and just live in that universe for a week or whatever it is and just soak it in. But I find novellas are doing really well. I think people are kind of compromising, and there's been a resurgence of novellas selling, particularly online through Kindle.
That's interesting, and that kind of takes us to our topic, which is how publishing has changed and how these electronic formats are making providing opportunities for forms maybe that. That weren't getting as much attention in the recent past. Although I'm really intrigued by the explanation of why people prefer a novel to short fiction, because I've always loved both. It's a very interesting dynamic between, because if you like speculative fiction, if you like fantasy and science fiction, there's something about the novelty of the world, right? It's not our world. It's this other world. But then there's also you want to be in a novel world you're familiar with, right? When you crack open an anthology of stories, it's like, well, okay, well, there was one weird premise. Oh, wait, now here's another weird premise, right? I guess that's taxing on people. Although, you know, if it's a good collection, I love that. I always found that to be tremendous fun. How about you, Stephen? You need to weigh in on this. Short fiction versus novels.
Short versus long. I love a good short story, and maybe something that as we see a resurgence of shorter fiction, authors might consider is maybe self-publishing in sort of an app model, where people, you know, buy a short story for $1 or something, you know, through the Kindle or in some ways, an ebook version of short stories, very cheaply. I noticed Tobias, your short story collection, Tides, help me with the title. I'm sorry. Tides from New
World. Sure. It's Tides from the New World. Yeah.
It is for sale currently, on Kindle, on the Kindle for 99 cents. So, and that's how many stories you have there? 17, something like that. 18 maybe, it's something like that. And
so
I mean, you talk about a good, if you like short fiction, and I can tell you, our guest is an excellent speculative fiction author. I highly recommend that short anthology. But there's another anthology that you've just put out, and I thought we might talk about that just a little bit. And I'm going to ask a very impertinent question because you're a friend and I can ask impertinent questions.
Okay.
Is this,
all right.
Is this anthology a act of courage? Are I don't know.
Or hard-headedness? Yeah. What's going
on?
Yeah,
I'm profiting from from short stories that have otherwise have failed. I mean, how do you look at this, Tobias?
Well, you know, it would be wrong of me to deny a cynic, you know, the assigning me the proper motivation there. Ultimately, we all want to make money. I live in a capitalist society. I don't want to have to feel ashamed for saying that I'm trying to make a buck here. I've got twins, man.
Absolutely.
There's two of everything. Every time there's a toy, I got to buy two of them. You know, okay, well,
I feel you, man. I feel you.
Here's the situation. It's two things at once. The idea for Nascence came about because I put together the collection Tides from the New Worlds myself about a year ago out of a desire to experiment with ebooks. I've been really involved in testing ebooks. I, you know, played with a bunch of different ebook readers. And a year ago, I started work on trying to learn how to make ebooks with the help of Pablo Defendini, who's an amazing designer and a very technologically plugged in guy. If you want to talk about the future of ebooks and technology and reading technology, you guys should have him on the show sometime because he's amazing, extremely smart, and one of those people that you kind of go, yes, I'm very glad he's in my sphere of, you know, smart people to reach out to. So he did a fantastic version of Tides from the New Worlds. He's responsible for most of it and gave it to me in a non-DRM format so that I could open it up and look at how he did it and kind of get around to understanding it and trying to tweak it and turn it into the book I wanted down the road. So I spent a few months, you know, doing that and putting it up for sale because I wanted to play with different price points and to see how many it actually sold. There's a lot of, I would say, rhetoric. There's a lot of just craziness about ebooks right now out there. And I really hate not having data. You know, every time I talk about the fact, you know, every time I end up in a discussion about ebooks, you know, someone says things like, you know, disintermediation and no middlemen and revolution and blah, 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 blah. And none of those words really particularly mean anything. If anything, they're kind of insulting because I was born in the aftermath of a revolution. And whenever it's used cheaply just to mean some things are changing in my comfortable white-collar world, I get really annoyed with people. So I put that up for sale, and it is sold. As you said, it's currently 99 cents. I started it out at $2.99. I bumped it up to $4.99 for a while, and then I sold it for 99 cents just because I'm gathering data. I've spent a whole year not really advertising it or pushing it, but just putting it on my site and with no push and no words, just seeing how it sells naturally. And I'm going to be writing a post about my experience, but I can talk about it a little bit on this show because it's not going to hurt me to put the data out there. But, you know, when it first came out, it was selling about 20 to 30 copies a month for a couple months. And then, of course, it just kind of, you know, goes down a bit, which is the way most novels work, even in the print world. You get that first 2 months of sales and then. And that was making me at $2.99, like, I think, $40 to $50 profit a month. But then after that, I slid down to making like $16 or $17 a month, which, having talked to a lot of people off the record, is not out of whack with what they're making, depending on where they are. Basically, it's like some people are making a lot of money off of ebooks, and it depends on their platform. You know, romance does well because 50 to 60% of all readers are romance readers. So the moment you decide to do science fiction, that's like 3.5% of the reading public. So the difference between 50% potential and 3.5% potential means, you know, people who say I'm making $1,000 a month off of an ebook means that at the moment you decide to write in science fiction, you can probably guess that you're going to be making like 50 to 100 on a successful ebook, just right, because of the fact that the readership is a smaller slice of the pie. That's the way the genres distribute. So one, you know, you probably should write, you know, if you want a successful ebook in a genre that, you know, most people want to read, or at least hybridize it. But that's true of even in the print world. I mean, you know, if you want to do something that pays a little bit more than a science fiction novel, you try to find a more, you know, more something that will appeal across the different groups.
So what do you say the three of us get together offline after the show, and I've got an idea for like this kind of pasty, annoying vampire, okay? But
yeah, does he sparkle?
Oh yeah, he's you know, the whole thing, you know. He's very sad, and I don't know. He would piss me off to
he's
no
tortured,
end if I
yeah.
saw him in real life, but I think there's something
yeah.
there. I think there's something there. Because there's this one girl and only she understands him, okay? Only she gets him.
But the thing is, and here's the thing though, is that like I wouldn't be passionate about writing that. You know, like cynically,
oh, yeah,
I mean I
yeah.
you know, you could, you know, I really think you got to follow your passion.
Of
yeah,
course.
I didn't get into writing to become super rich. You know, if I wanted to sell my soul, I would be, you know, I'd be working on Wall Street in some capacity. So this isn't entirely all about the money, and it isn't entirely all about entertainment, or I'd be writing knockoff versions of Transformers 3 all the time. So it's just, it's, you know, there's I want to be doing what I'm doing, and if I can achieve success or making a living off of it with some tweaks, then I'm happy. And so it's like, yeah, I mean, you know, if an author chooses to write about, you know, sparkly vampires because they love sparkly vampires, chances are that they probably have a wider potential audience than the fact that I'm going to decide to write my next book about, you know, sinking starships, just because immediately a very large amount of the potential audience will self-select out of saying, well, I don't want to read about intelligent starships, and that's okay. There's nothing
right.
wrong with that. But it just means my target audience is a lot potentially smaller. So taking that into account, I really wanted to put out. And then, of course, like I said, short story collections sell even smaller than a novel. So I've put out a short story collection that's in a niche, you know. So it's kind of like, okay, so I'm solidly aiming this ebook at like 0.09% of the potential audience that's out there. Go me. But I was really curious to get some actual data. And after it sold for like 4 or 5 months at, you know, $17 to $20 with the $2.99 spot, I then raised it to $4.99, which everyone told me not to do. Everyone was like, "Oh my gosh, you'll make even less money, you idiot." And I was
right.
like, "Well, I don't know if that's true, you know, because I think that the people who are buying it are the people who are going to buy it anyway because it's a Tobias Buckell short story collection,
right?
And there may be there's some play here." So I put it up at $4.99, and I actually started to sell more than I was at $2.99, oddly enough. And I moved back up to selling $40 to $50, you know, in that range, like low 40s a month again, which was intriguing to me. And then, of course, I dropped it down to 99 cents just to see what would happen. And promptly what happened is we sold this. I said I did that on the first of this month.
Mm-hmm.
We sold like 110 copies. Now, when you say, oh, I sold 110 copies in a month, everyone goes like, oh, my friggin' God, that's awesome. But at 99 cents, that means you're making like a quarter per book.
Right.
So I think
right.
it comes out to me, I think I'm matching what I sold when it was $4.99, but again, there was that real brief pop, and then it's trailed off. And so it looks like next month I'm probably more likely to make about 25 to 30. So obviously for me, the $4.99 price point is actually perfect. And I think I'm going to bump it back up now in a couple days to $4.99. And that's why Nascence, this new short story collection, debuted at $4.99. And Nascence is just another ebook, and it's got a slightly wider audience because it is both a writing book, a book about writing, and a short story collection. Because what I wanted to do was A, hybridize my potential audience, like I was talking about earlier. This is all the business speak side. And I wanted to see if it would make more. And so far, it's sold three times as many copies as Tides in its first month. So obviously, it's got more potential audience, and it's selling much better. And I'm, you know, actually this book is actually, you know, if it keeps selling at this rate, which I don't think it will, but, you know, it has a potential to actually allow me to go out to dinner a couple extra times a month, which is nice.
Fantastic.
And, yeah, you know, and take the twins with me. But but what it was, you know, I've written like 100 short stories before I started to sell short stories. I've written 145 total in my 15 years. And I've sold 45 of them, and 100 of them haven't sold, and 100 of them are just, to be quite honest, crap. And that's part of the apprenticeship period for me,
right.
is to write lots and lots of really bad stories and get lots and lots of rejections. And I was just sitting around one day. I had gotten a call from an editor who was just like, you know, I've heard you talk about the fact that you have all these trunk stories. We'd love you to revise one and submit it to us, and we'd like to pay you, you know, decent coin. And I said, you know, it's just easier for me to write a new one from scratch that's going to be good and that I know will be good, you know, using all the tools I have at my disposal now at this stage in my career, than it would be for me to revise one of these quickly and cynically and sell it to you. And I said, but let me take a look. And I went back and I looked at the stories and I looked at the best ones I had in there. And I said, oh, they still just require all this work. And here's what's wrong with this one. And here's what's wrong with this one. And as I was saying that, I thought to myself, oh, now, but how can I still, you know, like something in the back of my head was like, yeah, but how could you make money off this? You know, like what, how could you frame these stories in such a way that they would be acceptable and useful to someone and that someone would be excited about reading them? And I thought, these comments I have as I'm looking at them, like, this is why I don't want to revise it. This is why it's not worth the trouble to me. If I were to write all that up as an essay, I could probably put that into an ebook and sell it online, like, you know, some thoughts on stories that failed and how to make them better. And then as I was doing that, I thought, well, let's not just make it an essay. Let's just put the stories that failed right next to the essays too, so that people can see. You know, and I thought as a new writer, I would have loved that. Robert Solberg in his collection, The Secret Sharers, had the opening first page of a story that he rewrote like six different times to get it sold. And I remember like for 2 years, that was like the most practical guidebook I'd ever come across to what it took to rewrite a story and how to make it better. And out of all the writing manuals I'd read. And so I thought this could be something. This could be interesting. You know, taking all these stories of mine that sucked over a 10-year period and looking at the first one in 96 all the way to the last one in 2004 and just dissecting each one with a brief essay at the front saying, here's everything that's messed up about this story. So on the one hand, it would be useful to new writers. On the other hand, people who loved my fiction or liked my writing could read these and actually see kind of what I was trying to get at early on in my career that later would become my trademarks. And that's definitely in there. So people who are like dedicated fans would be kind of like, ooh, this is cool. This is interesting. A look back into the early days of Tobias. And three, and this is something one of my friends pointed out after I came out with, after I showed him the collection. He was like, and you know, this would prevent the question of like, he's like, you could probably sell some of these stories now, as flawed as they are, with some tweaking. Very quick tweaking, but like people would come across them and go like, oh my gosh, Toby's gotten kind of worse, hasn't he? Like he's really let himself go short story wise. And that wouldn't be good, you know? And I was like, but if I do this, I could be like, here, some stories, you might enjoy them, particularly the ones towards the end, the ones in like 2002 to 2004. There are like three or four stories there that are entertaining, you know, they're not completely insipid and dull. And this is a way that I could just give those stories out to someone and they could pay me for them. But I could frame them with an essay at the very beginning that says, yeah, I know that sucks for this reason, but it's never going to get fixed, you know, but here, enjoy it for what it is. And it sort of takes away that sort of like, I bought this and it sucked. And it's sort of like, yeah, I know.
I haven't told you why. I explained it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I've read the first three. Yeah, I read the first three, Toby. I read the first three, and I got to tell you that even though they sucked, they were still interesting. If that makes sense. I mean, it was.
Sure.
Sometimes they suck for technical reasons, but the ideas behind the stories are still great. And you're thinking to yourself, well, I sure hope that this writer grows up so that one day he can, you know what I'm saying? You're pulling for this guy, you know? You're saying, hey, that's great. You know, in one of your essays, though, you said something I thought was just fascinating and is just good advice for a writer in general that's trying to break through. You set a goal for yourself, and it wasn't to be accepted or to get one of your stories published. You want to talk about that goal a little bit? You know what I'm referring to?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I know exactly what goal you're referring to. I read a lot of self-help books. It's sort of an embarrassing hobby of mine. And it's not because I'm worried about myself, but I'm always intrigued at, you know, nowadays they call it life hacks and there are websites for it and everyone's really into it. But back when I was in college, like there wasn't any sort of, you know, group water cooler where you could hang around like that looking for life hacks. And so what I would do is I just read books looking for tips and tricks. And one of the tips and tricks that I picked up in one of the books was about controlling, doing things that you can control to achieve greater results. In other words, like a lot of people get hung up on quote-unquote goals when what they're really talking about are milestones. So a lot of people say, oh, my goal this year is to sell a short story. And that's a really bad goal because you actually don't have any control over it. You can't force someone to buy a short story of yours. That's why so many writers get really frustrated and go down really wrong, weird paths. It's because they're looking at the wrong goals, I think. And so what I figured out early on was that I didn't want to focus on things that I couldn't control. And I couldn't control whether I was going to sell anything or become a writer or sell a novel. But what I could control was working to get better and submitting, which are the foundations towards eventually selling. You know, selling was out of my control, but I could control the steps right up to selling. And so I had read this anecdote by Mr. Ray Bradbury, where he said he'd gotten 500 rejections before his first sale. On his 500th, you know, submission, he got back a, okay, yeah, we'll buy this. And I was kind of floored by that because Ray Bradbury started out in like the 30s when there were like hundreds of pulp magazines with very low standards. And I thought, good grief. You know, if this literary giant of our field got 500 rejections when it was easy to sell a short story back in the day, then I really, you know, can't compare myself. I can't say that, oh, well, I should get less than 500 rejections before I break in. So I set myself a goal of 500 rejections. I figured, you know, if I hadn't learned something or figured something out by 500 rejections, then I would reexamine the idea of becoming a writer. And so I then broke that down, like, okay, so how do I get 500 rejections? And so my goal then became, okay, let's do a five-year period of trying to get 100 rejections a year. And so I was like, so how do I get 100 rejections a year? Well, I have to write X number of short stories and submit them to X number of markets. And I came up with a rough metric of needing to write about a short story a month, continuous, you know, one new short story a month, to get it into submission, to get enough stories out there that are out to enough simultaneous different markets that I would get 100 rejections a year. And so then everything just kind of followed from that goal, and I just reorganized my life. In order to write a short story a month, I had to, you know, spend this many days a week writing this many words. And so it just I just kept breaking everything down and putting it into action. And that's what I did. I was writing more like a short story every 2 or 3 weeks for a while. That's why I wrote 100 of them. And submitting them to markets as fast as I could. The very first year I did this, I had 139 rejections, I think, which when explained to people sounds devastating, but because they were things I was trying to achieve, I was like, dude, I got 139 rejections. I did not just get 100. I overachieved. I got like 40% right. more okay, rejections good. Than I'd set out to achieve. I'm a winner.
You know, it's funny you told that story because I experienced the exact same thing in my love life. But anyway, I'm just kidding. No, I mean, but I think it's just an awesome story. I love that. I think that that's and you know, to any person that's out there that wants to break in the field, you know, and you ask them, well, how many times have you submitted? Well, you know, twice. And, you know, that's, you really have to, it's in some ways it's a numbers game, and you took that time to hone your craft. I mean, you were 100 stories into it before you really, started becoming the writer you are today, I guess. Is that fair to say, or was it just
incrementally? I started selling somewhere around 80 or 90, I started selling, but I continued to write bad stories along with the good for a while. It took a while for the good stories to kind of start to outweigh the bad ones. As I show in Masons, one of the examples I give is a short story I wrote called, I'm completely blanking. I think Closed Cycles is the short story. I wrote that the same week that I wrote a short story called In Orbite Medievali, which went on to win a quarter of the Writers of the Future contest, has been reprinted a couple times, and it's been translated into a couple different languages. So it's been a very successful story for me. I wrote it the same week as I wrote this story called Closed Cycles. And Closed Cycles is such a bad story that friends of mine from the Clarion workshop, the class that I was, you know, that class of 99, still remember it 15 years later for how bad it was. And I wrote them both the same week. Same person, same amount of education, same amount of talent. I wrote both those stories, both the one of the worst stories I'd written in just ages and one of the better ones, like within 2 days of each other. So it's just, you know, there was a period where I was doing that a lot. And then eventually it got to the point where in somewhere around 2004, 2005, I think since 2005, I have not lost a story. I haven't trunked any stories. I've sold every story I've written since like 2005, which is, to me, is amazing. I still, when I send a story out to an editor, I still kind of sit there and go like, oh, I didn't quite nail this, and you know, but I can't do any better. This is the best possible thing I can do, but I can just see where it could be that much more amazing, maybe, you know, and oh, they're not going to like it, or, you know, or even if you think it's great, you just think, oh, I don't know, maybe I took too much of a risk on it and it's just too out there. And then they come back with, oh, I loved it. And you're just like, oh, thank goodness.
That's awesome.
Well, I love that idea of doing the things that you can control. I think that's really profound. That just puts an awful lot of things into perspective. When you talk about Ray, I had never heard that before, that Ray Bradbury submitted 500 stories before.
I'm sure it's completely apocryphal that he sold it on his 500th, but I mean, yeah. it's a great story.
Yeah, maybe 473rd or something, right? But he rounded it off probably when he told the story.
But we'll give him license.
Yeah, well, of course. Yeah, you know, you have to think that that reality. I mean, a lot of people who could have been great probably crashed up on those shores. You know, just never made it, right? Because it just
it all the time, though.
Too daunting.
I see it. I was telling someone else that I am not the best. I've never been the best possible writer out of my peers. I've always been the solid C student, B minus student there, you know. But I just keep leveling up. I've just never given up. And it was like, you know, when I was in, you know, I mean, even as far back as high school, there were better writers than me around me, you know, and better artists and just creative individuals, but I just kept at it. I never stopped. And then when I got into college, I was in the creative writing program, and there were people who could turn a phrase better than me in the creative writing program. I mean, they weren't writing science fiction, they were writing other things, but they were better than me, but they just didn't keep at it. And by the time I was a senior, I started to sell stories occasionally, and they had started to get ready for going into the working life. And when I was in the day job, I then was surrounded by other writers who were selling short stories. I had a handful of them, and I wasn't the best, you know. Many of my peers and friends, you know, were getting nominated for awards and winning awards who, you know, were around me. And I just was like, doggedly, I'm still at it. And I would look back and realize that, oh, you know, those people in high school or those people in college that were around me who are better now just don't do it anymore.
Right.
Or they've gotten rusty because they're not practicing anymore. And now I'm actually better than them. And then, you know, it's like now it just keeps going. I kind of look back and think, oh my gosh, you know, I'm just still there. And still always doing it. And I look at the stuff I'm writing now compared to the stuff I was writing 10 years ago. And I thought, and you think just like, holy crap, there's been so much growth. And I know so much about writing compared to what I knew then. And it's just only because I just keep doing it day in and day out and day in and day out. And after a while, it was like a friend of mine who was a doctor said that, you know, even he's like, I've been doing this for so long, surgery, that even, you know, my worst day, I'm better than any brilliant student on their best day. You know,
right.
It's like, you know, when they call me at 3 a.m. and I'm like wiping my face off and tired. And, you know, it was just 2 hours ago that I left the surgery and I go back into the surgery and they're like, oh my gosh, you need to do X, Y, Z quick. This person's in a lot of trouble. He's like, I'm still going to be the best bet rather than a student who's rested, ready, and genius, because I've practiced so much more. I've done this for so much longer. I've got so much more experience under my belt that it's like, okay, even tired, I can be like, we're going to do X, Y, Z, do this, do this, do that, do that. Boom. The person is saved. They're back together. And I was like, that's a really good point. You know, it's just that practice, you become better.
Hey, can I bring a movie reference into this?
Oh, no.
Bring
well,
it.
Okay, but that's it. That's it for the show. If we
yeah, we're going to be just – no, no. One movie reference to prove
this. Go ahead. You can.
have you guys seen Battle of Los Angeles yet?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, I haven't seen it yet. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, I won't spoil it for you just to
– Don't ruin
just,
it.
Yeah. It was filmed right in my hometown, and I got to see some things being filmed, and it was awesome. And,
okay.
You know, too bad they had – Right, and too bad they had to rebuild Shreveport after it was done. But
they,
anyway,
right, they filmed Battle for Los Angeles in Shreveport.
They sure did.
That's awesome. That's cool.
But anyway, a character within that movie, just, it was sort of he went through a character arc very similar to what you were just talking about, Tobias. He was, you know, when they introduced him, he's obviously a guy in his mid-40s. You know, he's jogging on the beach trying to stay in shape. He's a Marine, and all these, you know, 19, 20-year-old Marines are passing him on the beach, so, you know, greeting him good morning as they pass him at like three times at his face, you know, and he's having to ice his knee, you know, and it's just, it's very much the, you know, the Robert Murtaugh, too old for this stuff kind
sure.
of thing, you know. And, of course, then, you know, he goes through, he proves himself as the best Marine there was, simply because he, you know, not because he's the physical specimen he had been 20 years before, but just because he knew so much. And
yeah,
and you know, you just there's something to be said for experience in any line of work. So
yeah,
absolutely,
definitely. No, it's you know, I was thinking of like the Malcolm Gladwell book. And the other one on about mastery, about the 10,000 hours of practice that's needed to become good at
right.
something. And I really think that applies on so many different levels. And I'm grateful now that I'm able to do almost full time writing, because it just means that I'm able to throw that much more time and energy into it than I would have, than I could have when I was working a part time or a full time job.
Absolutely.
Now, in the chat room, Sally observes that she had read that Asimov had rejections much later in his career. That he dealt with them. He dealt with them even after he was well established. And I remember reading that Robert A. Heinlein actually sold the first story he ever wrote. So it seems that there's a lot of among the greats, right? Among these 20th century great science fiction writers, there was kind of a variety of experiences that they had. But you had to be ready for, I think, what Bradbury experienced. And what I like about the process, really, that you've outlined there, is just that it's a way of getting your head around, you know, instead of being washed up on the rocks, of dealing day to day with something that you truly want to do and making it possible to do it. I think that's actually quite inspiring.
Oh, thank you. It's the focusing on what you can control has been huge in my life. I recovered from a heart defect recently, and it really hammered home like how much I had to focus on that, because there was so much that was out of my control about how fast I was healing, how fast I was getting my health back, and all those other things. It was just a case of, like, you know, focusing on, you know, like one day I could walk a half a block, you know, and that was all I could do. And I could do this much work, and then just letting go of the stuff I couldn't control. It was just like, you know, that stuff will have to sort itself out because it's not my focus. I can't control it. It'll resolve itself or not, whatever. And I just have to do what I have to do. And a lot of people spend a lot of time worrying about things that they can't control that are not within their get. And it's amazing to, when you burrow down on stuff you can control and just slough off things you can't, then you're able to, I think, enjoy life a little bit more. And a lot of studies show that, what is that called? Your ability to direct your own world. I'm blanking here now, but, self-guiding. Oh, yes. This is why I'm a writer and not a speaker person, right?
Self-actualization? No.
But the ability to control
power.
Your own fate.
Yeah.
This ability to control your own fate. Autonomy is the word I'm looking for.
Oh, okay.
There we go.
Autonomy. Gotcha.
Okay. Now we'll just have to go back and delete the last couple of minutes there where I looked like an idiot and step back over with autonomy.
Phil and I will get our turn in a minute to look like idiots, so don't worry about it.
Yeah,
we all have
every week. Yeah.
But no matter what you work, if you have autonomy, your satisfaction with life just rockets way up.
Right.
And in order to get autonomy, focusing on things you can control is important. I mean, I always felt like my focusing on rejections made me feel like I was completely in control of the entire process of being a newbie writer. It was like, hey, I'm working towards getting 100 rejections. I can achieve this. There's no reason why I can't achieve this. That, you know, if I get published, that's great. That's a milestone. But that's not a goal. And sure enough, you know, when I started to get published, that was super awesome, you know. And now it's like, you know, what I focus on are word counts or completed projects rather than rejections and things like that. But I still only try to focus on things I can control, you know, and it really helps me stay in a proper positive mindset and has been able to let me kind of get through the last couple of years with a fairly decent amount of productivity and fun even.
That's awesome. Now, let's stick with that idea of autonomy, because I think that relates to one of the other notions we wanted to get into tonight, and we touched on it briefly. I wrote a piece last week. I was picking up on something that Seth – I never know how to pronounce this guy's last name. It's Godin or Godin. I'm not sure. I guess Godin. Anyway, the marketing guy, the guy who writes all those books with, like, the top
Seth, the god of marketing.
Yeah. There it is. That's the man. Yes, he had a piece on his blog. Reject the tyranny of being picked. Pick yourself. And he was talking about how basically the web has enabled us to function with many fewer gatekeepers than we used to. Now, there still are a lot of gatekeepers, but there's also the ability for people just to say, "Here's my stuff. It's out there." Right. So whereas there's this whole process that you describe of becoming a professional and actually, you know, honing your craft and developing skills. And there's also this thing about I've written something and I wish other people could see it, which now no one has to worry about, right? I mean, you can if you want to, you can show it to a lot of people, right? You can put it out there to a lot of people. And in terms of in terms of financial success, he uses some pretty interesting examples. Amanda Hawking, who stole my vampire idea, is you know, making $1 million a year, $1 million a year according to this site, publishing her own books to the Kindles. No publisher, just her.
Yeah.
And this Rebecca Black, who's had 15 million listeners on YouTube, with her, she's like a 13-year-old kid who's recording music now with millions of people listening. So. And he contrasts that with, like, you know, crappy books from the past and crappy songs from the past, which is not to say that there's not an awful lot of crap being put out. Surely the web has created the possibility for more crap to be produced than ever before. I mean, it's the beauty and the genius of it. But how does that world look to you? I mean, you've talked about taking steps into it. In a very, like, methodical and controlled and disciplined way, with putting your books up and doing these interesting experiments around the pricing of it. But does it feel to you like it's barbarians at the gates? You know, are there, like, are there all these, like, little sniveling creatures nipping at your heels, or is it just a different world? Or, you know, how do you, as a writer who's come up through the ranks, how do you view that world, and do you see that potentially as someplace you'll end up?
Well, first of all, the writing world is always changing. If you talk to authors who've been around for a long time, they will talk to you about any number. You know, change comes every decade or so, drastic change. And when I first came in, I came in when the death of the mid-list author happened, where there was this huge collapse of people who are making, you know, $30,000 to $40,000 a year, writing, you know, a couple novels a year very comfortably. And that changed with a focus on bestsellers and, you know, efforts to throw new writers at the wall to see if they'd stick, which is what the industry currently exists as, when the a decision by the IRS came about that forced publishing companies to have to account for their current inventory, which meant that keeping a book around in a warehouse became a liability, which is why the current structure that we have exists and there are not so many mid-list writers. So these, you know, giant changes. We just had a huge distribution channel change a few years ago, just 2 years ago. I think it was, 2008. We just went through a huge collapse. So there's always stuff like this happening. The ebook transition is another big, huge change coming down the pike, and one we've been looking at and thinking about for the past 5 years. And it's always hard to figure out what's happening when there's a major change like this, to figure out who the winners and losers are going to be. Because in the last one, there was winners and losers, and there'll be winners and losers in this one. And we're not entirely sure who those people will be. They may even not be the people who are currently succeeding. So you have no idea. So first of all, anyone who predicts how this is going to play out and work out is just full of crap, I think. That's mm-hmm. just my personal opinion. I love data. I love charts. I love stuff like that. Because when we look at one person like Amanda Hawking, what we're doing basically is saying that you should adopt her strategy because she's done well. But we don't know if she's an outlier or if she's in the middle of the data trend. For example, like saying you should follow Amanda Hawking's decision is like saying, hey, I should write young adult fantasy about boys with glasses who have wizarding powers because that'll make me a billionaire, guaranteed.
Right.
And that's what a lot of people who didn't know jack squat about publishing were saying when Harry Potter was coming out. Everyone was coming up to me and being like, you should write a bestseller about, like, you know, young adult fantasy.
Right.
And I was like, well, yeah, again, obviously there's a larger audience for it and people are doing really well in it, but it doesn't automatically mean I would be able to tap into that. And
right.
there are lots of people who have written some young adult fantasy that have done well, and there are lots of people who have written young adult fantasy that hasn't done well at all. Right. And as Amanda Hawking herself, who's actually a very brilliant tactician, if you read her blog, and who's very well measured and thinks about this stuff a lot, I actually have been sending a lot of people her way because I think she's one of the people who's benefiting from the e-publishing revolution, who has a level head on her shoulders and calls it like it is. I've been encouraging people to read and listen to her as much as possible and pay attention to what she's doing, because she pointed out she has a lot of friends who are following and trying to do what she's doing who are not having the success she's having, and she doesn't understand why. So in other words, she's a part of a zeitgeist or a meme or some explosion there, and she's benefiting from it, but she doesn't even know if it's completely 100% replicable. And people who are trying to replicate it, who are friends of hers that she's cheering on, aren't able, not able to replicate it. So she's kind of saying, hey, you know, like, I'm glad this is happening to me. This is great. But this rhetoric about lack of middlemen and disintermediation doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get the same results. And I think the reason is, and I do have a little bit of a theory, so I'm going to be the people I just said are full of crap and give you my full of crap interpretation.
Fair enough.
Think it's barbarians at the gate. I think that this stuff, you have to think about this stuff in terms of leverages and bases and exposure. So basically what happens is when you get rid of the middleman, you've got a shorter lever. In other words, yes, you can sell direct one-to-one, and you just anyone can become a quote-unquote novelist now just by going to the Kindle Direct store and putting something up there. And that's cool, but it doesn't mean you're going to get everyone listening to what you have to say. The vast majority of people, when I go to the Kindle Direct forums and look at their sales, if they're willing to talk about sales numbers, are selling a handful of copies. And that's always the case with people who are self-publishing. Some people are achieving more, and some people are building careers like Amanda Hawking, and some people are actually, who we don't talk about but should talk about, are not selling millions of copies, but are actually selling, like, you know, $500 a month, $1,000 a month's worth of copies. And those people, I think, are the ones we should pay more attention to and talk to, because those are people who are inside of the power distribution curve where there are opportunities. The chances are that you're going to become an Amanda Hawking are probably actually really slim, because she really is an outlier and not everyone is selling like she is. But what you want to look at is to see how people are doing in the middle. And in science fiction, I'm hearing a lot of authors who occasionally will share data. And it looks like, you know, a book can do about $200 a month if you have $200 a month of royalty income, if you have some sort of base or name recognition. And that's the key right there, name recognition. So how do you get name recognition? Well, in my case, I have it because lots of readers have been exposed to my books in bookstores. So actually, e-publishing is great for me because I already have a base to leverage from that gets me lots of readers and attention. So I know I can put my short story collection out there for $4.99, and I know that like 10 people a month are going to buy it. And, you know, that's a base I have. Someone else who no one has ever heard of is probably going to put up a short story collection. I don't know what they're going to sell, but I'm guessing they're going to struggle to sell 10 copies a month, which isn't really all that much, even on my part. And if they're trying to sell a novel, it's the same thing. And so that's something to be aware of. It doesn't mean you shouldn't e-publish, but it just means that you're not going to probably see the results you think you're going to see. And I hear a lot of people who get excited. I go to a lot of conventions, and a lot of wannabe writers come up to me, and I use the term wannabe. That sounds like I'm being insulting. I didn't mean that to be insulting, but a lot of writers who would like to have a career and write full-time come up to me, and they say, hey, I'm going to put it up on Amazon because, you know, the evil corporate New York publishing doesn't understand what I'm doing, or because I believe disintermediation is awesome. And they always argue with me and tell me that my theory about the business of it is wrong, you know, that they're probably not going to make much money. And then I try to follow up with them, but a lot of them just don't answer my emails like 3 months later after they put their book up online. And it's not that hard to extrapolate using Amazon rankings what sales are. I have a couple tools that let me do that. And from what I can tell, they're selling, you know, a couple copies a month at best.
Right.
Because no one knows who the hell they are, right? People who give away free novels, like, here, please take it, are selling handfuls of copies.
Right.
Or, you know, getting handfuls of downloads. So if you can't give it away for free if no one knows who you are, how do you expect people to buy it if they don't know who you are? So that's the tricky part. How do you become known? And that comes back to, like, marketing and quality of the work. You know, Amanda Hawken points out that she wrote 10 books before she started putting them up online. 10. So when people say, I want to pull an Amanda Hawken, I'm like, great. Have you written 10 original novels?
Right.
No. I'm like, well, then you're not going to pull an Amanda Hawken because you have not put in the work she put in. She put in a serious amount of work on her craft. 10 novels is a lot of work, dude. She's put in serious apprentice time. And by the time she got to those later novels, she has to have had a sense of how to tell a story. So even though she wasn't able to sell it, which could be considered an indictment of, you know, agents in New York publishing and whatever, she, at that point, obviously had the skill set to tell an interesting story, which means that then, you know, word spreads, people enjoy what she's reading, people buy the other books. And the people who've written one novel or a continuing series of 4 books that are, you know, all set in the same world, on and on and on and on, they're thinking, oh, great, I'll just put this up on Amazon and I'll pull in Amanda Hawken. And I'm like, no, you don't, you're not telling as good a story as she is yet. She really put in her time. And that counts for something. And she admits that she still has a way to go because she wants to get editors and copy editors and things like that so she could become even better. So this is a woman who is completely and utterly committed to her craft in a way that a lot of people who just want the feeling of being a novelist aren't.
Right.
You know, she is really in there. She's worried about the words. She's worried about the misspelling. She's worried about the craft of it. And that makes for, I think, a great writer. You know, no matter what you may think of her works or not, she's obviously very committed to the craft, and I have a lot of respect for that. And obviously, as you can tell, she's headed for a – she just signed one – she's going for a one or two – no, it's a $2 million contract now with print publishing. So obviously, she's not hung up on the rhetoric of only one way. She's playing all the different things simultaneously. So some of the people who have given up print publishing and said that they're going for electronic only – I just look at that and I think, oh, but why? I mean, there are foreign rights you can sell. There are readers who are still only in print. They only want to read print. And so basically what you're doing is voluntarily saying that, like, I'm going to give up a fraction of my potential sales and I'm going to spurn this industry and talk crap about it and focus only on this. And I think specialization is always dangerous, whether it's you're specializing in just print, you know, or just electronic. I think just the word specialization always gets my hackles going up. It always makes me go like, yeah, you're making a bet, you know, and if for some reason it doesn't work out, if you're depending on your understanding the field 100%, you know, let's suppose that, like, the reason you're selling so well is that, like, you know, there's this glut of new people coming in and maybe it's going to level off. You know, that's happened to me in for example, when I worked with FictionWise, they were taking short stories of ours when the electronic age of fiction was just getting started in 2000. And it was great because for the first 2 years, there wasn't enough content on FictionWise. And so people were finding our short stories and buying them like mad. I was making a few hundred dollars off of each short story that I had up there. And I thought, wow, if this continues and I can put like 30 or so short stories up there, I could be making, you know, several thousand dollars a year off my short fiction consistently. But then abruptly after the end of 2 years, it really leveled off because people got into so many more authors and so much more choice and so much more other stuff that I just suddenly went down to selling just a handful of short stories every year through them. And so there is that, you know, there's a fact that just because something is happening the way it's happening doesn't mean it's going to continue to happen that way. I don't know if that's true for ebooks. I suspect that it's not, but that's why I just think, yeah, you know, I don't want to be the dinosaur that looks up and sees a comment and goes, oh, crap, that was the wrong choice.
Well, listen, I'm sorry to cut you off. We're right at the end of our time. We could probably have gone another hour on this. It's endlessly fascinating. But you know, it sounds to me like the bottom line is the dynamic has changed before. It can change again. Also, it's not that there are no gatekeepers. It's just that we've moved them to the cloud, right? And the gatekeepers are everyone. And
And one of the funny side effects of that is that actually there'll probably be fewer bestsellers electronically than there are in print, because it's a sharper distribution curve. Anyone who's on the top 20 Amazon list will get a lot of sales, but once you drop off that Amazon bestseller list, your copies just drop really dramatically. You know, because discoverability is a big problem right now with ebooks. It's something I've been hammering on my blog. So, you know, they're going to be winners and losers.
Absolutely. Well, with that, I know we've run over our time, and the chat room can't hear us anymore. But
oh, okay.
So actually, we could go another hour. I think, is that right?
Yeah. Go as long as we want to. It'll be recorded, and people can hear it in MP3. But the live listeners have dropped off. So.
I'm glad we got a chance to talk about this. I think this is very important, and your perspective is just terrific to get. It's wonderful to hear it from the inside, you know.
Yeah, I think there are lots of opportunities, which is why I'm obviously playing with ebooks. Actually, I'm an ebook designer for Subterranean Press now, and so I'm very committed to knowing a lot about how ebooks work and how they're selling and all of this stuff, and I love it. I mean, to me, it is amazing, because I think it's going to allow the return of mid-list writers if they're able to play their cards well. But I think a lot of people are getting caught up in the sort of revolutionary zeal of everything and making a lot of weird choices in terms of their rhetoric. And it's just a case of like, you know, hey, it's another opportunity. Stick your finger in it is how I look at it. I'm getting involved in it, you know, and if it helps me make some extra money, that's great. But, you know, it's not exactly like I'm running away from my print publishers, because what they offer me is leverage, which is the ability to stick my cover out in front of way more people than I can using just my existing resources. They're kind of like it's the ability to stand on the shoulder of a giant in order to exceed my usual grasp.
And ultimately, at the end of the day, focus on what you can control, right? Whatever channel you're working in.
Exactly. Amanda Hawking is the perfect example of that. What can she – you know, she'd written 10 books. She'd been unable to get people interested in them, and so she focused on what she could control. I will put this up online myself. I think I can do that. And, you know, if that's the way you want to go, that's the way you want to go. But, you know, just think about the fact that you could be giving away a potentially good-selling book. I mean, people tell me I'm scared of the competition. The fact of the matter is less – taking more people away from print publishing is actually beneficial to me.
Sure, of course.
I'm not scared of it. I'm just worried about running into someone who's a great novelist who doesn't have the leverage to catapult themselves up into a position where they should be seen more. You know, I always hate when I see a great writer done bad, you know, whether it's through their own efforts or through, you know, some bad process. And it happens in big print publishing too. But I would hate to think that the next great Werner Vinge is going to like put his novel up online, you know, and maybe no one discovers it just through a freak accident, so it doesn't get read by everyone. You know, that's kind of like in the back of my head, like, oh, that would suck, you know. But of course, that could be happening. The next great Werner Vinge could be, you know, getting turned down right now by a large print publisher. So, I mean, it goes both ways. It's
sure.
Just, I just think you should play. You know, like I said, specialization is bad. You want to be someone who, you know, keeps all your avenues open.
Well, that's just generally a good way to poise yourself for the future. For anything, you know, as soon as you assume how things are going to be, they're not going to be that way. I mean, it's just
exactly. I agree with you 100%.
It's just kind of how the world works. Well, again, thank you for joining us. How are you doing, by the way? Just health wise, are you
great, man.
On the mend, feeling fine?
I'm on the mend. I have a very mild version of what I have, and so I've been walking a lot. I've lost almost 40 pounds, so that's good for the heart. And just focused on, I walk every day and think about what I'm going to write. So it's been really good creatively, and it's been wonderful to sort of get back into shape finally after, you know, the year of kind of recovering from what had happened. I have something called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is what, like a lot of athletes, when they suddenly die of a heart problem, you stress yourself out or push yourself too hard and your heart starts to misfire. And yeah, it turns out I have it. Didn't know. Runs in the family, and collapsed from it. And now I'm pretty much fully recovered, back to normal. I just have to take medicine that controls my heart rate for the rest of my life. But that's a small price to pay for, you know, surviving.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we're glad to hear you're doing well. Glad to hear that that you're writing and producing more stuff for us to look forward to. And we also look forward to having you back on the show in the near future. We'll try not to make it such a long break this next time.
I would love to be back on with you guys. I have a lot of fun.
Well, we did too, and we thank you for being with us. So, Stephen, what's our music this evening?
Our music tonight is Living My Life by Oliver Trolley.
Oliver Trolley singing Living My Life. Well, thank you for putting that together, Stephen, and I want to thank all our listeners via MP3, particularly those who are listening via MP3 after having heard the show die. They're listening live. if you listened live, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We're going to be back on Saturday with the World Transformed 1.5 archive show on Monday, and 1 week from tonight, another live edition of Fast Forward Radio. So hope you'll be able to join us for all of those programs. And until next time, live to see it.
We grew, walking the zoo, but looking into colored lines.